Morning, Your Honors. Bryce Tondre, registration number 14454, appearing on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Mrs. Dorsey. The issue presented to the court today is a relatively narrow one. It's whether or not the arbitrator had the authority to do what the arbitrator did. I think while arbitration is a favored method in Colorado, only the parties to the litigation can empower the arbitrator to do a particular thing. The question here is, what was the arbitrator empowered to do with respect to interpretation of the separation agreement? I didn't find any cases that were particularly all square on point, but Treadwell versus Village Homes gives us some idea that the court approves an agreement where the party said the district court's not empowered to do anything. Everything goes to the arbitrator. We've got something a little different than that here. We've got the parties saying the district court is the exclusive interpreter of the agreement. And that, to me, means that the parties did not empower the arbitrator to interpret the agreement.
Counsel, given the breadth of Section 1013, which says that the parties agree that they will try to settle, and they use the language, any claim or controversy arising out of or as a result of their dissolution of marriage, if they had intended to, if they wanted disputes about, you know, what the terms of the agreement meant to be decided by somebody other than the arbitrator, couldn't they have said so in Section 1013? Because the way I read it, it's pretty broad. I don't see how a dispute about how much the husband's final payment, what it amounts to, how that's not something that arises out of or resulted from the dissolution of marriage. I mean, there wouldn't be a payment due at the end of a period of time if the parties hadn't divorced.
1008 precedes 1013. 1008 specifically says that before you get to 1013, the district court has to interpret the agreement. And we have no dispute here that the arbitrator interpreted the agreement. The district court agrees the arbitrator interpreted the agreement. The appellees agree that the arbitrator interpreted the agreement. And we can't just throw out a provision that says the exclusive jurisdiction to interpret this agreement rests in the district court. That's a specific directive from the parties where they want the interpretation to fall. It's a court's order. The court should interpret it, not the arbitrator, and that was their choice. In Treadwell versus Village Homes, the parties took the opposite approach. They said, we don't want the district court deciding anything. We want everything to go to the arbitrator. What their purpose was, I don't know, but the purpose here was, if we have a dispute as to the interpretation, then we want the district court to decide it. Taking away that right to have the district court decide takes away the right of appeal. So you can't appeal an interpretation by an arbitrator. We've got a second issue in this case where the arbitrator failed to follow the dictates of the promissory note and failed to award default interest on the amount that the arbitrator found was in default. So I think in answer to your question, Your Honor, is I think the specific has to overrule, or maybe that's not the right term, I think the specific has to control rather than the general. I mean, once you get the interpretation of the agreement, then the arbitrator can decide what falls within that interpreted that interpretation by the district court or not.
But applying that very principle, that the specific controls over the general. It seems to me that 10.8, section 10.8, generally talks about, again, governing law. We're going to operate under the laws of Colorado, jurisdiction, you know, the venue that you're going to use, the city and county of Denver, versus 10.13 is more specific in that, well, it's specific but also very broad, in that it says you're going to resolve any claim or controversy arising or as a result of the dissolution of marriage through the arbitration process. And again, I don't see how a dispute over what is owed at the end of the day wouldn't fall within that very language, that specific but broad language.
Well, the dispute of the amount may fall within the within 10.13, but the dispute as to what the contract means falls within 10.08. And it's, I beg to differ with you. That is not a venue provision. That's a jurisdiction provision. It says the district court shall have the exclusive on interpretation. That's jurisdiction. That's not venue.
Well, it does also specify that you're going to have it heard in the city and county of Denver, but that's beside the point. My question is, I just don't understand how something having to do with how much the husband owes at the end, you know, his final payment, how that's not a claim or controversy arising or as a result of their dissolution of marriage.
Well, there was some of that in the decision. For example, the arbitrator decided that certain items that Mr. Dorsey claimed as remediation expenses were not allowable. That clearly falls within something outside interpretation. Is it remediation or isn't it remediation? It didn't require any interpretation of remediation, but it does require an interpretation as to whether 5.2a or 5a or whatever applies. And I think that the clear language which must bind the court is that the district court has the exclusive jurisdiction, not venue, the exclusive jurisdiction to decide issues of interpretation.
Mr. Tondry?
Yes, sir.
That same section upon which you rely on 10.8 also says that the District Court of Denver has exclusive jurisdiction on matters relating to the enforcement of the agreement, not simply the interpretation of it. And so do you take that same position, that the district court has exclusive jurisdiction for enforcement of the agreement? And if so, doesn't that render totally unnecessary and superfluous the arbitration provision?
Well, I don't think it, and the answer to your question is yes, I do say that it's exclusive to the district court to enforce. For example, let's take a contempt proceeding for failure to follow the dictates of the separation agreement. That would be the exclusive jurisdiction of the district court, even though it may involve the computation of some numbers as to what he did or didn't do. But I think the language here is clear, that the parties did not want the arbitrator to decide the interpretation of the agreement or the enforcement of the agreement.
Well, counsel, I'm really having a hard time seeing how a dispute over compliance with the agreement wouldn't be enforcement of the agreement. If that is enforcement of the agreement, then there is nothing for an arbitrator to do. And that reads that clause completely out of the contract.
It's not, enforcement is...
I'm waiting for a concrete example, not abstractions. Give me a concrete example of something you think an arbitrator could decide that's not enforcement of the agreement and doesn't involve interpretation of the agreement.
Well, we've got one here, remediation. What constitutes remediation? Mr. Dorsey took the position that a suit he filed against a supplier or a workman constituted remediation. The arbitrator said, no, it doesn't.
But that clearly requires interpretation of the agreement. What's meant by remediation, and it clearly involves enforcement in the agreement. What did the parties intend? Who's right and who's wrong? How do we enforce it? clearly.
Well, I don't think that includes interpretation at all. There's no question as to what remediation is.
Well, if that were true, we wouldn't have a dispute. But there's a dispute between the parties. They disagree as to what it encompasses.
There's a dispute. There's no doubt about it. But that's something that doesn't require interpretation of the contract. It doesn't require interpretation, remediation.
But your client is asking for enforcement of the agreement by virtue of this remediation issue, okay? She wants a certain enforcement of the agreement. The other side wants a different enforcement of the agreement. It's all enforcement. I you're not giving me a real concrete example of what an arbitrator could decide. It seems to me more a matter of convenience. You want to decide certain things, but not others. And frankly, it seems like a mess. I don't know what a court's supposed to do. Is the court supposed to decide an issue of legal interpretation of law and send it to an arbitrator? That's bizarre.
Well, I don't want arbitration at all. From the get-go in this case, I opposed arbitration because I thought the contract needed to be interpreted. And when you look at 5A and 5.4 and that the three series of items which required serious interpretation, I think you can see some concrete reasons for interpretation of the agreement. I mean, it's a $750,000 issue as to whether 5A, I'm losing the numbers right now, but whether the mortgage payments, for example, get included in the credits. And that's something that's got to be interpreted. Dispute as to what falls within remediation. Remediation's a well-known term, but what the parties meant by the contract is not. That's something that's got to be decided by the district court, not by the arbitrator. And I'm not picking and choosing and cherry picking. I started out from the very beginning opposing arbitration because I think that interpretation is critical.
But I thought you just said the remediation issue could be decided by the arbitrator.
The amount of the remediation issue. I mean, remediation, there's no dispute as to remediation. He's entitled to credits for remediation.
But the parties disagree as to what that means.
No, but that's
not interpretation.
That's not an interpretation issue. That's an issue of looking at it. Remediation, what does remediation mean?
And your position is determining what a contract term means is not interpretation? Is that your position?
No, my position is that determining the application of the agreement or the clarification, I mean, you have to look at the district court's opinion. The district court in Judge Gilman, that's the one opinion we got. She refers in there that it was referred to the arbitrator for determination of ambiguity. And determination of whether or not something is ambiguous is clearly contract interpretation, which has got to be relegated to the district court. And with respect to the interest issue, I mean, there's no doubt that she exceeded her power in refusing to provide for interest on the default amount. And I've cited a case in my brief that clearly establishes that that's outside the power. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Tondre.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael DeManna. My registration number is 2300. With me at council table is my co-counsel, Ms. Neethi Pawar, registration number 24729. Ms. Pawar drafted the legal arguments in this case. And also, I have the pleasure of having sitting at council table with me my client, Mr. John Dorsey. With the court's permission, I never thought that we would be continuing to involve ourselves in litigation in a case that on the 20th of this month will be 7 years old since the parties voluntarily and knowingly, with the assistance of very competent counsel, entered into a separation agreement to determine the issues of their marriage. I was one of the original lawyers involved in the case, filed the case on behalf of Mr. Dorsey in 2005, and negotiated the settlement of the case with Mr. Kanges, Michael Kanges, in 2007, which is the agreement that's before you, and I guess provisions of which are in dispute by the wife. In 42 years now of practicing domestic relations law, what I have noticed in the last several years is that parties have decided, given the expense and also just candidly the clog of the court docket, to look at alternative means of dispute resolution when it comes to dealing with the issues in their divorce or dissolution of marriage cases. They sometimes do that at the beginning or during the middle of the case, but they often do it toward the end of the case, because in most domestic cases there are always action which needs to be taken following the execution and approval of the agreement by a court. For example, people wish to sell their homes. They often don't have that done by the time the case is finished. People wish to divide their personal property. Also, they don't get that done at the time that the case is finished. In this particular case, there were several provisions in the agreement that dealt with issues that needed to be accomplished subsequent to the signing of the document and its approval. For example, Mr. Dorsey's $4 million note needed to be secured, and the terms of the security on the note are specifically provided for by the terms of the agreement, separation agreement, that in the event of a dispute, those issues are to be arbitrated. The arbitrator is named, and the process is laid out as far as how that's to be done. As the note's being paid down, Mr. Dorsey's entitled to substitute his collateral that he put up at the beginning of the note. Again, in the event there's a dispute, the agreement specifically says that issue shall be arbitrated, names the arbiter, and says what's to be done.
Counsel, let's get right to it, though. Do we have a conflict here between 10.8 and 10.13? If we don't have a conflict, how are they reconcilable?
10.8 deals with the venue, that is where the case is to be a venue for enforcement purposes, and it also deals with what laws to apply when the agreement is to be interpreted. That's all 10.8 does. So if the parties move to Wyoming and they have a dispute, the Wyoming court is directed to look at Colorado law to determine what the agreement should say. And in the event that there's an enforcement action, for example, contempt citation, something to that effect, the venue of the case is placed in the Denver District Court.
Counsel, but aren't you effectively reading out part of the final clause of 10.8, which, you know, says that, you know, the state of Colorado shall have exclusive and continuing jurisdiction over matters relating to the interpretation and enforcement of the agreement? I'm fine with the enforcement part, but why? I mean, we can't just ignore that there's also this clause, the interpretation.
Your Honor, respectfully, what I believe that this boilerplate provision is used for is when we had a dispute in this case as to whether or not there was the issues to be mediated and arbitrated. We asked the district court to interpret the terms of the agreement as to what issues should go to mediation and arbitration. And as you correctly said to counsel, all claims or controversies arising under the terms of the agreement were to be mediated first, and if that failed, they were to be arbitrated. So that's the interpretation of the issue. What issues before the court, and is that an issue that the parties agreed to submit to binding, to first to mediation, not a binding resolution, a mediated resolution, only binding if the parties agree, and if not, it then went to the binding resolution of arbitration. So that's what the district judge did in interpreting the agreement. The judge said, what's the issue in controversy? As you correctly pointed out this morning, the issue in controversy was, had the promissory note been paid, and what credits were to be applied to it? And was that a claim arising out of the terms of this agreement and the marriage of the parties? Yes, it was. Therefore, what did the parties agree to do with it? Send it to mediation. We tried that with Judge Bachman, Harlan Bachman, and when that failed, the parties were directed to pick an arbiter, and that was Judge Post, Cheryl Post, who arbitrated the terms of the agreement and entered an award. So that's the 10.8 governing law provision. The substantive rule here is the what's to be submitted to arbitration. If the appellant's position is to be believed, as Justice Jones was asking, there would be nothing for the arbiter to be able to do. An arbiter listens, as you know, an arbiter listens to the case, takes the facts, looks at the document, applies the facts to the terms of the document and the laws of the state, and makes a determination. That's exactly what Judge Post did in this case. She heard the facts of the case and the dispute, she looked at the terms of the agreement, she applied it to the facts of the case, and entered an award. And here we are with a continued controversy that virtually has no merit and no justification. Well, these parties specifically agreed on a number of issues that the matter was to be out of the district court and into the alternative dispute resolution of arbitration.
Counsel, I recognize that that's how things usually go in arbitration, but what we're trying to do here is take two clauses that might seem to conflict and reconcile them. So it seems to me there might be some room for the court to make decisions on the interpretation of the agreement and something left over for the arbitrator to do, or some kinds of disputes that the arbitrator can decide.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that that is an extremely complicated, cumbersome, and now expensive process. Because what would have to be done is that the dispute would need to be identified. That has to be done for arbitration. Then I guess we would take the dispute to the district court to say, how does the terms of this agreement apply to this dispute? In fact, do the terms of the agreement apply to this dispute? And if the district court said, yes, the terms of the agreement apply to the dispute, then what happens? Case is directed to arbitration. That's why our clients are looking for a mechanism to stop that. That's extremely expensive and incredibly complicated and incredibly cumbersome to the court's docket to be able to have to look at these each individual issue here, or even several issues, and determine whether or not the agreement applies to them. That's why, as I say, it is very standard now in the practice in Colorado. In fact, I can't think of an agreement which I have written in the last several years that doesn't contain some form of alternative dispute resolution relating to disputes regarding the application of and the terms of and the interpretation of the agreement. So those issues just simply go to arbitration, which is candidly where they belong and where this issue belongs. The bottom line here is Mrs. Dorsey's been unhappy with her deal here since the very beginning. We raised in our brief, and you may be aware, she's filed a motion to reopen the case. That was denied. Appealed to your court, denied. Now on cert to the Supreme Court, that hasn't been ruled on. Now when she got virtually all the money, in fact, more money than she was entitled to under the terms of the agreement, millions of dollars, by the way, she's unhappy with that result. So even though it was submitted to binding arbitration, she had two different judges now decide that that was the proper venue and forum for it. Then she didn't like the interim award, so she went to the judge and asked it to be overturned. That was denied, and now here we are in front of the Court of Appeals. Reason I'm bringing that up is that I would really urge this court to consider our request for attorney's fees in this case. Mrs. Dorsey is not likely to stop this effort to unravel her negotiated settlement now on her second or third attorney unless the court imposes some penalty here. If there was ever a case that was frivolous, groundless, and without merit, it is this case. And we believe that the only way to get Mrs. Dorsey's attention, and I'm not dealing here with a impoverished homemaker. Mrs. Dorsey, under the terms of this agreement, received close to $9 million, both in assets and cash. So she certainly has the ability to pay for the expense my client has incurred in trying to have her uphold an agreement that she entered into well over 7 years now. So I would again respectfully urge the court to look at the attorney's fees issues. And finally, let me say this, there's no reason for me to use all of this time. If the appellant's argument is drawn to its logical conclusion, there would never be an issue that could be decided in arbitration. there would never be an issue that could be decided there. Because every issue would need to be first addressed to the district court to determine whether or not the agreement applied to it or didn't, and how the agreement was to be interpreted in its application, and then sent to arbitration. There would be no...
Counsel, let me ask you the converse. Under the terms here, 10.8 and 10.13, is there anything that is outside the purview of the arbitrator? Is there anything that is left for the court to do?
Yes.
And what is that?
In the event that Mr. Dorsey did not execute the promissory note for $4 million, he might be in contempt of court. That issue, the contempt issue, would have to be determined by the district court.
But that goes to enforcement. Is there anything under the interpretation clause of 10.8 that the court would be authorized to undertake?
One issue, in my opinion, Your Honor, and that is whether or not the subject matter of the dispute is proper to be arbitrated.
And that's what the court did here.
Exactly. That's what two courts did here. The first was Judge Robbins who did that, and then when he left the bench, it was Judge Gilman who, when they petitioned for a review of the award, said, look, this is properly before, was properly submitted to the arbiter for determination. The arbiter's made a determination, was well within her authority to make that determination. The issues that were submitted were fully identified and fully litigated. End of story. I appreciate the court's attention and our time this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. DeManna. Mr. Tondre, you have about a minute for rebuttal if you'd like it.
Thank you. One example of what should have been decided by the district court here that I could give you just on reflection, 5.2A of the separation agreement defines net proceeds. It doesn't include 5.2. The arbitrator gave a credit for what was paid under 5.2. That should have been, we asked the district court to interpret that agreement before the district court sent it to arbitration. The district court didn't interpret that. The arbitrator, without any explanation, gave Mr. Dorsey credit for payments made under 5.2 when 5.2A limited it to things other than 5.2. So that's one thing that clearly should have been decided by the district court before it went to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator could then have, there probably wouldn't have been a dispute. At that point, if the district judge had interpreted the agreement, and that's also true with the other provisions that I pointed out in my brief.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Tondre. Thank you both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.